Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. Every noon on Saturday Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm health journalist and Huffington Post blogger, Allison Rose Levy. I've been covering integrative health for the last 25 years in books, magazines, and the internet. And I've been on Huffington since 2007, one of the earliest health bloggers. It's my joy to bring you this show, which talks about the connection between personal health and our total health environment, including our food, our environment, our attitudes and beliefs about health, and the decisions we make as a society about healthcare, food, and the environment, and even energy. Today's show is going to be really terrific. We have a terrific guest, Dr. David Perlmutter. And before I bring him on, I just want to give you our featured health action of the week, because this has been a very exciting week on many levels in terms of people standing up for what they believe in, what matters to us most. So I begin every show with a featured health action, and our featured health action of the week with all the links so that I don't have to kind of be here on the air when you have to run for a pencil to write it down, giving all these WW links. But I have links every week where you can take action on a selected form of health activism. And our featured action of the week is take a stand with Mark Ruffalo and Josh Fox to protect safe drinking water. Mark Ruffalo, as you know, is an actor. He's been nominated for an Academy Award for his role in the film The Kids Are All Right. And Josh Fox is the director of the film Gasland, which has also been nominated for an Oscar in the Best Documentary category. This week, they went to Congress and met with Capitol Hill. They met with their Congress people, and Josh Fox has issued a letter calling for appropriate governmental action, safety studies, and really looking into the impact of a novel form of gas drilling called hydrofracking, which puts toxic chemicals, over 500 of them, into the ground to bring up the gas, and these are often then found to contaminate drinking water. This has happened across country, and that's what Gasland is about. So on Connect the Dots, we both talk about ways to detoxify and protect ourselves and protect our health and the health of our children. We also talk about ways to protect all our citizens through appropriate health actions. So this week we have two actions where you can reach out to President Obama, as well as if you're in the Northeast region, there's an action to prevent immediate drilling that's going to begin in an area that serves 15 million people in New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. So both actions are featured at healthjournalistblog.com. It's called Featured Action, Take a Stand with Mark Ruffalo and Josh Fox, and I thank you for your activism. Every bit counts. And actually, this is a great fit with our guest today, who's someone really who knows a great deal about protecting our health, the health of our children, about detoxification, and, you know, to maintaining functional neurology and brain. He is leading neurologist David Perlmutter, the author of a whole number of terrific books, which I've been following for many years, Brain Recovery, The Better Brain Book, Life Guide, Your Guide to a Longer and Healthy Life, and Raise a Smarter Child by Kindergarten, of concern to parents nowadays. And his latest book, I've been following his work for quite some time, which is co-authored with Alberto Viviodo, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, is, I think, his best one so far. It's a terrific book called Power Up Your Brain, The Neuroscience of Enlightenment. And so we'll be discussing that with him today. And I want to welcome you to our show, Dr. Perlmutter.
Well, it's absolutely my pleasure to be here. And I really, the introduction, I think, is so very, very timely. You know, many of the issues that we deal with from a neurologic perspective are really now pretty well demonstrated to be a consequence of things that we expose ourselves to in the environment. And again, you know, talking about the DVD Gasland, I think it's so fundamentally important that people take a look at that, because, you know, we live in a world right now where, while we celebrate hopefully the democratization of Middle Eastern countries and the establishment of a free marketplace, you know, in some regards, the downside of the free marketplace, when We simply pursue things for their monetary value at all costs, including the cost of the environment, needs to be looked at. I mean, what happened to us in this country with the so-called Halliburton loophole is, you know, we've seen this incredible toxification of groundwater throughout vast areas of the Rust Belt states and even into the Northeast with, as you mentioned, this fracking technique, technology injecting over a mixture of more than 500 poorly researched chemicals into the groundwater in order to extract the natural gas. And it's an incredibly compelling documentary, and I would certainly urge your listeners to consider being supportive by buying the DVD and watching the DVD. And, you know, we really need to have much more accountability in terms of what people are doing to our precious resources. And, you know, we're living, leaving a worrisome legacy for our children in terms of a toxic environment. One of the main things that I'm exploring now, and really one of the key pillars of the new book, Power Up Your Brain, is really this whole concept of what we call epigenetics, where the various lifestyle choices that we pursue, including the foods we eat, the supplements we take, the exercise we get or we don't get, sleep, stress, etc., how all of these factors actually affect turning on and off our DNA, so that we're able now to understand that all of our choices, more than just taking in enough protein and a good antioxidant here and there, all of our lifestyle choices actually affect the very expression of our own DNA, a science that's called epigenetics. And that's a very, very powerful contention, that we can affect our genetic destiny. We can modify where we're going to go in terms of health and longevity by changing our lifestyle in such a way that we can activate more sustaining types of genes. You know, the downside to that is living in an environment that exposes our genome, our DNA, to toxins to which it has never been exposed to in the past is indeed, you know, a very worrisome sort of scenario. We wonder why our rates of longevity now seem to have peaked out and we're starting to lose ground. And, you know, a lot of it does have to do not only with our personal lifestyle choices, but indeed what's going on around us environmentally, over which we should have some more control.
Exactly. We're so on the same page, and regular listeners to the show, as well as those who read my blogs on Huffington, you know, get an earful about this, because, you know, my personal history is that I've been covering integrative health as a journalist and reporter for over 20 years. I've been an early advocate and promoter of all of the empowering nutritional, lifestyle, stress management, and other, you know, changes in awareness that we can do to promote health. But at a certain point, you know, when the society is kind of creating more trouble, more stressors, and sort of pushing in the other direction, you know, we kind of have to both do what we can for our personal health and also, you know, not hide out, you know, in the myth that our individual actions alone will be sufficient. And we're seeing that especially with children as well being affected by some of these environmental inputs. And I just want to say, I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about that, because I know that you have, you know, a wonderful specialty in working with kids and families, Dr. Perlmutter. You know, we had the President's Cancer Panel report, and there have been numerous studies that show that, you know, young children and babies are born pre-polluted. You know, so are we at a time where we can still look at, you know, say, an individual factor as a smoking gun and say this caused it or this didn't cause it? Or is it really a case where there are multiple things that are kind of affecting children in ways that we can't fully assess?
Well, I think, as you do, I write for Huffington Post. And interestingly enough, my post earlier this week dealt with preventing Alzheimer's disease. What a concept. Mm. And, you know, just received a huge number of comments, most of which were supportive. But several of the comments were along the lines of, well, you know, I know that Dr. Perlmutter has provided the data showing that those individuals who exercise more and who have less body weight, for example, have less risk, or a lower homocysteine or whatever it might be, higher level of DHA, an omega-3, are at less risk. But I know a guy down the street who exercised all his life and then got Alzheimer's. Or I know a guy who never exercised and did this or that. So, you know, the point is, and I just actually posted a comment just before I came on the air with you this morning, and that is that anecdote is interesting. You know, when we know a person who was in a terrible car accident, wasn't wearing a seatbelt, and yet survived. Okay, that's great. But can we generalize those individual experiences to the population at large? And no, we can't. The beauty of these large retrospective studies is they look at large populations and try to determine what are the trends. What are the odds? Well, odds are if you're wearing your seatbelt and you're in a car accident, you're going to do better. Odds are if you don't smoke, you'll be less at risk for lung cancer. Odds are if your homocysteine is low, if you've got plenty of omega-3s in your diet, especially DHA, and you exercise, that your risk for Alzheimer's will be less. It doesn't translate to a guarantee to that individual person, much as specific toxins, for example, that you were discussing with respect to children can have an effect on that particular child. We like to look at big trends. We like to learn from history. You know, there was an interesting report that appeared in the New York Times a couple of months ago, and actually I have a link to it on my most recent Huffington Post, and it really it dealt with the fact that in their view, the only meaningful studies to which we could hang our hats on had to do with had to be what were called double-blind interventional trial. The name of the article was years ago, No Magic Bullet with respect to Alzheimer's disease was published in the New York Times. So basically what they said was that unless we have an interventional trial moving forward, that looking back at the data is meaningless. So, you know, these lifestyle studies that say, well, over the past 20 years, those who exercised more had less risk for whatever, those they said were virtually meaningless, basically paving the way only for the gold standard to be a drug, because drugs are the only thing that people are going to pay for to study moving forward. But that said, you know, that's what prompted my most recent post about actually preventing Alzheimer's disease. And again, you know, it's sort of predicated on one of the fundamental parts of the book, Power Up Your Brain, that we just published, and that is that we can affect our gene expression in a positive way, and here's how. So, you know, I have to admit that, you know, I was very surprised that within a week after Power Up Your Brain was published, it became a national bestseller, not because we've done a lot of media, I don't believe, but because I think the message is really important and people want to hear the message, and that is, what can I do? What can I do to protect my brain? You know, there's a lot of talk about preventing heart disease by exercising, keeping your bones strong by weight-bearing exercise, taking vitamin D, etc. But the idea of a program to increase brain function and to keep your brain resistant to disease somehow doesn't, you know, hasn't gotten a lot of traction as of late, or really ever. And truth of the matter is, the data there is absolutely outstanding and comes from our most well-respected institutions.
Mm-hmm. So what have you found in that regard, in terms of, you know, so we can basically, what we're saying is we need to kind of act on two fronts. One, to create a more hospitable environment that kind of reflects our health priorities and supports our epigenome, and at the same time that we need to take, you know, kind of individual action to protect our, you know, our health and our brains and our epigenome in this current toxic environment. So what are you recommending?
Well, again, You're right on target. It is absolutely the program that we talk about in Power Up Your Brain is fundamentally focused upon our epigenome. In other words, what are our modifiable lifestyle factors that affect our gene expression? And I think you're going to be in New York at the Integrative Medicine conference.
Mm-hmm.
That's the title of my lecture. I'm doing a keynote exactly on that topic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, what is this empowering information that we can affect our own gene expression to have better, in this case, brain health? And, you know, there are a couple of very simple factors. A wonderful report was published in just January 31st of this year, that demonstrated actual growth in the memory center of the brain in individuals who exercised for a one-year period compared to those who did not. The area of the brain that mediates memory is an area called the hippocampus. And generally, loss of substance in the hippocampus is one of the hallmarks of Alzheimer's disease. As your memory center shrinks, your memory function declines, and that's one of the hallmarks of Alzheimer's. In those individuals who didn't engage in the exercise program, their hippocampus shrank an average of 1 to 2% per year, and in those who did exercise, it actually grew. What a concept. The brain actually increased in size. The brain grew new brain cells. And, you know, back when I was in medical school, that would have been considered blasphemy to consider to discuss the fact that the brain could regenerate itself. Well, now it's really pretty much ingrained in mainstream science that we all are experiencing what's called neurogenesis, the growth of new brain cells, every minute of our lives. And the real question that you would ask is, well, that being said, what can I do to protect the brain cells I have? But moreover, is there a way I can turn on this process of growing new brain cells? I mean, who wouldn't want to have new and healthy, vital, functioning brain cells? You know, obviously everybody, especially when you remember back in college days where the rumor went around that everyone, every time you drank a beer, you'd lose 20,000 brain cells or whatever the magic number was. So, you know, in point of fact, we can grow a new brain. What a powerful and empowering concept that now is really pretty much front and center in mainstream science. And you know, I think that's one of the keys that we talked about in Power Up Your Brain. What are those epigenetic, as you so well characterize, factors that turn on the creation in the brain of a hormone called brain-derived neurotrophic factor that not only grows new brain cells, but allows existing neurons to make better connections to each other so the brain can communicate within itself in a better way. And basically, believe it or not, it's those good old lifestyle factors of exercise, of reducing your caloric intake, and taking high dosages of a specific omega-3 called DHA. That being said, you know, these are not overwhelmingly dramatic or life-compromising issues. We do know that excessive calorie intake, which is unfortunately very typical of the American adult, actually suppresses brain-derived neurotrophic factor and is associated with a more rapid loss of brain substance and even cognitive decline. So we are, in a very real sense, in the driver's seat on this one, being able to dictate to ourselves what kind of brain we're going to have next year and in 5 years and in 10 years. When faced with the statistic that if we live to be age 85, our risk for being diagnosed with Alzheimer's in America is an incredible 50-50, flip of a coin.
Really? Oh,
yeah.
My.
That's breathtaking. To me, you know, that absolutely defines an epidemic.
What is causing this?
Well, good question. And I think we again get back to gene expression. We know that there are certain genetic predispositions for Alzheimer's. And interestingly enough, one of the other Huffington Posts that I published recently dealt with fascinating a new finding that perhaps herpes simplex virus type 1, which is responsible for cold sores, may play a very pivotal role in initiating the inflammation in the brain that is so characteristic of the Alzheimer's patient. You know, for years we've looked upon the collection in the brain of a very specific protein called amyloid protein as being kind of the hallmark of Alzheimer's, and indeed, pharmaceutical companies have labored long and hard with extensive financial investment to try to find or develop a drug that could perhaps rid the brain of beta amyloid, thinking that that's the cause. And every time they try these drugs, patients deteriorate more quickly. So a group of researchers at Harvard last year published a report in which they said that amyloid, beta amyloid that accumulates in the Alzheimer's brain, might actually be a good thing. And in fact, it might actually be the brain's attempt to deal with a virus, like herpes simplex virus. So, you know, we're in a kind of a revolutionary time in looking at brain problems, at brain pathology. But I wanted, if I could for just a moment, to focus on the other subtitle of our book. It's called, Yes, Power Up Your Brain. But the subtitle is The Neuroscience of Enlightenment. And that's the upside of brain science today. And that is, aside from just trying to make a brain that's resistant to Alzheimer's and other types of degenerative problems, what's the upside? What can we do to empower ourselves in terms of building a brain that, yeah, our brain's getting us through our day-to-day lives, but what about being better? What about building a brain that has more access to those specific brain parts, that part of brain anatomy that allows us to be better people, to allow us to be more compassionate, more empathetic, more able to plan in a positive way for our future?
Mm-hmm.
We know that the human brain has a unique structure unlike other animals called the prefrontal cortex. It's kind of our gift. You know, we have that. We have what we call the opposable thumb. These are unique characteristics of humans. You know, we're not the fastest animal in the forest, nor are we the strongest, but we are the most clever, perhaps, because we have this big brain in comparison to our body size. And that said, one of the unique structures of the brain is area up front, above your eyes, called the prefrontal cortex, that is really the most sophisticated part of our brain, not found in other animals, that really defines us. And actually, new studies using advanced brain scans published by researchers at the University of Pennsylvania, Andrew Newberg is a neuroradiologist there, has demonstrated that those individuals who are involved in things like meditation and prayer actually activate those so-called spiritual parts of the brain.
Hmm.
And through this ability that we describe in our new book, Power Up Your Brain, we're able to enhance the brain's ability to tap into those areas so that with the appropriate nutrients, with the appropriate lifestyle issues that I've already mentioned that act through gene activation, we can enhance these processes of meditation and prayer to actually turn on those brain areas that mediate those activities, that allow us to have that spiritual experience. So, you know, it's a wonderful and absolutely revolutionary time in brain science, and how incredible it is to me to see kind of the overwhelming public interest in this idea that, you know, here's a way to get to those brain centers that are our gift, and that when we get into those areas of the brain, it allows us to be the people we really need to be, and that's kind of a revolutionary thought. But the timing, to me, as we look around what's happening in the world today, you know, we're reaching sort of a crossroads where we can go one way or the other, and just in the past couple of weeks, you know, when we look at what's going on globally, it looks like we're going in the right direction finally. Changes are happening, and it's because we're really becoming enlightened people, enlightened beings, and, you know, things were looking pretty grim, and, you know, the road will still be rocky, but it looks that this glass may actually be half full, and it's a very, very powerful kind of suggestion that we're going in the right direction.
You know, that's a really, I'm so glad you're tying it into recent activities because, you know, sometimes it feels like the conversations that we have about health are occurring in a bubble, you know, where it's me and my personal health, and yet, you know, the activities and challenges and changes and opportunities that are going on in the world around us can no longer be ignored. So, for example, you know, when you're talking about spirituality, enlightenment, and those kinds of things, I think there's long has been, you know, I've been a yoga and meditation student for 30 plus years or something, you know, trained yoga teacher, all of that, traveled abroad and studied with all kinds of teachers. You know, for many years there was a kind of feeling, you know, that spirituality meant kind of being in a beatific, calm mood, retiring to a cave, being by the ocean, you know, but as we see, you know, the earth being polluted, stresses in our government and democracy, economic threats that are, you know, kind of challenging people in their lives, all of these things, it's almost as if our concept of what constitutes spirituality or compassion also has to change. And, you know, the events that you've been pointing to, and I'm mentioning this because, you know, the show will be listened to in archives as well as this week, you know, we've had the legislators, you know, kind of walking out in order to protect the right to labor unions. We've, you know, in the last 2 weeks, we've had an uprising in Egypt. So what we used to define as spirituality is now looking a lot more like standing up and being present and taking action than maybe how we've been thinking about it for a while. I'd love to hear first your thoughts about that, and second, if there's any reflection of that in your understanding in terms of neurology or brain physiology.
Without a doubt. And, you know, the I think, you know, the thesis of Power Up Your Brain, the Neuroscience of Enlightenment, is really basically this, that whatever doctrine you choose to exercise from a religious or spiritual perspective is enhanced through the program that we describe. So there's nothing unique about what we describe in terms of a specific religious doctrine. It's simply a way to enhance your brain's ability to do what you think you want your brain to do, and especially from a spiritual perspective. You know, interestingly, getting back to the research from Dr. Newberg, University of Pennsylvania, in his book, How God Changes Your Brain, he showed that the changes that take place in the human brain during Buddhist meditation were the exact same changes that happened with Franciscan nuns. So it really doesn't matter. Basically, tapping into God or spirit or energy or whatever you choose to define or nomenclature you use to define what that energy and knowledge is that's around us, it all goes through the same pathway. It's all the same you know, satellite radio mechanism in your brain that allows you to receive the station. Mm-hmm. And you can receive that station. It can be any number of, it can be country western if you like that, or you know, it can be jazz. But the point is, the actual hardware is a specific part of the brain that allows you to gain access to that information, that energy. Again, call it what you like. And here are the techniques to make that happen. This is your gift, and this is a way to enhance your ability to make that happen much more readily and basically with much more efficacy, so that you don't need 8 years at an ashram. Or you don't need to be chanting, you know, in church, you know, for several hours every day. So the point is, you know, it is a defined set of hardware issues that allow that experience to take place. And what we define in the book is how to make that happen for you. Go your merry way and build a brain through this process of what is called neuroplasticity, the ability of the brain to reform itself. Build a better brain. The brain is absolutely and totally influenced by what it is exposed to. And when we expose the brain day in and day out to negativity, then the brain sees the world in a very negative way. And that individual becomes much more receptive to negativity and actually seeks out negativity. The point is that, you know, we have a lot of control over what we put into our brain in terms of stimulation on a daily basis. And when we choose to start our day by watching Fox News or CNN about murders and suicide bombers and reporters being raped, then we get a sense that the world is negative. But beyond that, we build a very negative-focused brain. You know, the brain is basically a computer, and it really reflects the software that's loaded into it and the information that's loaded into it. The beauty of this scenario is, however, we can change that. We can make changes, volitional changes, as of today, to start feeding our brain positivity. Start looking at the world as being a wonderful and beautiful place, seeing the glass as half full, turning away from the negativity, and beginning to pursue those issues in life that we feel are going to make us better, a better individual. So it's an absolute change that we can make, and the human brain will rewire itself and reflect those new changes. Even if you're 80 years old, even if you're 90 years old, we, throughout our lifetimes, retain this incredible ability called neuroplasticity, the ability of the brain to move forward. And not only can we develop and enhance these new positive pathways, but we can allow those pathways that are connected to negativity, to previous traumatic experiences, to the bad paradigms that we use to reflect our current life experiences from, we can allow those pathways to wither on the vine and not enhance them. The less attention we pay to those... Hello?
Hello.
Oh, I heard a little beep. And the more we pay attention and focus on positivity...
Hi. I think maybe it's a good time for a break. So, you know, we usually have a break for some announcements at this point in the show. So I think you've brought up some very interesting potentials, Dr. Perlmutter, and we'll talk a little bit more about them after we go into this break. And I just want to, ask our listeners to stay tuned for me on Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy speaking with Dr. David Perlmutter, author of the new book, Power Up Your Brain.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Don't miss out on Dr. Michio Kaku's weekly show, Explorations. Dr. Kaku is the only scientist with his own nationally syndicated radio show. Explorations is the program that explains complex physics with an accessible approach. So take an exploration with Dr. Michio Kaku, Tuesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, to discuss topics ranging from space exploration to stem cell research.
Join us, Bruce and Marianne Curtis, Fridays at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network for Truth and Freedom. We present provocative conversations with the world's most brilliant minds in the areas of holistic health, spiritual wisdom, politics, and a host of other topics. Some of our topics include the latest work in non-invasive therapy on the brain, the truth beneath the global economic meltdown, healing power of the breath, and the sublime truth beyond all religious traditions. In this age of transformation, we need to look beneath the surface appearance of things to see the underlying reality. For material that is always illuminating and often liberating, tune in to Truth and Freedom on the Progressive Radio Network Fridays at 3 p.m.
This is Bill Bowie.
And this is Kelsey Flynn.
Of Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability.
We bring you news and interviews
with the likes of Wangari Maathai, Bill McKibben, Hazel Henderson, Paul Hawken, Francis Moore-LePay, and many others. Tune in to Sea Change Radio here on the Progressive Radio Network on Saturdays at 7 in the evening.
With Sierra Club Radio. Tune in Fridays at 11 a.m. Eastern on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com to hear interviews with green authors, activists, politicians, celebrities, and more.
You are listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Welcome back, listeners, to Connect the Dots on Progressive Radio Network every noon Eastern Time on Saturday. I'm Allison Rose Levy, 25 years of health journalism, best-selling book writing, and I'm also a Huffington blogger. Our show, Connect the Dots, connects our personal health to our attitudes and beliefs about health, our total health environment, and the decisions we make as a society. My guest on today's show is Dr. David Perlmutter, He is the author of a wonderful new book called Power Up Your Brain, The Neuroscience of Enlightenment. And I like to do kind of the shout outs at the beginning of the segment here so that we can kind of, end our conversation with Dr. Perlmutter today at a high point in what we're actually talking about. So I'm sure that people who have been listening to the first half of our show and are here for the second half will be wanting to seek out this book and know more about his activities and offerings, which you can find online at www.powerupyourbrain.com. I highly recommend the book. It has both important tools you can use in your life as well as a lot of really terrific new health understandings presented in a very accessible way, but also not a, a dumbed down way, I would say. One of the things that that Dr. Perlmutter says in his book, which I found very interesting, is that kind of taking on more complex mental activities of various kinds is actually also what keeps the brain plastic and functioning. And I think that sort of going with more complex health understandings is part of that. I think there's a tendency in the commercial media, book publishing, and sort of idea information marketplace to sort of make health as simple as possible so that people don't feel overwhelmed. But there is also some complexity to health. Dr. Perlmutter's book, Power Up Your Brain, does a really great job of making that accessible. And I think that as we step up to master more about health, it will also kind of help our brains, as well as kind of put a more sophisticated health understanding and health reality. Something our health understanding will reflect our health reality rather than just kind of focusing on a few simple and easy ideas. Because, you know, as we can see, reality isn't always simple or easy. Now, I do have some questions for Dr. Perlmutter here in the next segment. And before we get into those, I have one of my own that I'd like to ask you, Dr. Perlmutter. In the last segment, you were talking about maintaining a positive attitude, you know, not beginning the day with negative happenings. You alluded to, you know, the fact that there was, you know, a tragic incident in Egypt where a news reporter was attacked. I'm just referencing it in case the show is listened to by people later. You know, not beginning the day with that. But and I agree with you. I think it's really important not to sort of jump in to the deep end of the pit first thing and sort of program your whole day accordingly. But, you know, at a certain point, just because I control my mind or my brain, you know, there is still stuff going out in the world. And so, you know, this brings us back to the idea that somehow embedded in spiritual understanding or this notion of being positive is the idea that in order to sort of be okay ourselves, take care of ourselves, that the way to do that is to retreat from some of these tougher and rougher things that may be going on out there. And, you know, if we take that pathway, then, you know, we've created a less stressful experience for ourselves in the short term. But if we do fail to address some of these societal conditions, because they're unpleasant to face up to, because they're challenging to deal with, because they make us upset or they make us angry or we feel disempowered, I say this as a collective psychologist, are we really doing ourselves a favor in the long term? Because they will come back at us as bigger stressors, whether they're environmental toxins that we don't regulate or, you know, societal threats to democratic institutions that are painful to look at or challenging to deal with. So, you know, while I think there is a role for positive attitudes so that one doesn't burn out, overwhelm, take on more, you know, than one can decently manage, you know, I think that there's been a kind of message in the integrative health and spiritual communities to sort of, you know, and I think it's consonant with what we've always heard about, you know, you get on the plane, you put the gas, you know, the oxygen mask on yourself first before you help your child. Oh, but it's become a kind of end in itself. You know, and yet some of these things in the world have been left unattended to. So how do we address those and not retreat from them?
Allison, it's a very good question. And I, and again, you know, through the ages, that question has been answered, I think, by many. Mother Teresa has been asked that question, how do you maintain your positive attitude and outlook in the face of adversity? And I think that's bottom line what you're getting at. And I think, you know, the answer to the question is you approach these issues with positivity, with joy and compassion. In the face of the obvious negative negativity that surrounds us, you know, every act of compassion is like taking communion. So we approach these things by lighting the single candle as opposed to cursing the darkness. So, you know, we all see this adversity around us, and we see situations that are not the way we would like them. But we approach these negative issues by being very positive about our outlook and positive about the influence that we are having in our day-to-day activities in trying to right these wrongs. So these things are not irreconcilable.
Mm-hmm. I hear you. And I just want to let you know that one of our listeners has commented and said, for many years, I've said we have lost our gentleness and compassion. Dr. Perlmutter gives me hope that we are seeing a slow change in the right direction. So
that absolutely made my day. And it is happening. We've got to, you know, we know that we can make this happen. We know that we are going to win the day. And the change is happening. It's been happening for, you know, a long time. But I think we're starting to see momentum gathering, and we're reaching a new age. You know, I was interviewed on tonic.com. It's a very interesting website, and the interviewer asked me 7 questions. And the very first and he asks every person he interviews the same 7 questions. The first question was, why are we here? That's, you know, take the wind out of your sails right off the bat. And I said that we are here to observe, participate, and usher in the greatest evolutionary change this planet has ever seen. And, you know, in the book we talk about how we are Homo sapiens, we are thinking beings, but that we are moving to a place of Homo luminous, of becoming enlightened beings. And, you know, one of the criticisms has always been through the ages, well, we always look upon being enlightened as something reserved for the very few. You know, in each generation there has been an enlightened individual that people call attention to and point a finger to. But in reality, being enlightened is not binary. It's not you either is or you ain't. Being enlightened is a question not of kind, but of degree. We are all enlightened beings because we are all participating in that energy, in that experience, in spirit, in God, at every moment of our lives by definition. But we can choose to become more enlightened by the actions that we as human beings through our volition choose to endure but choose to accomplish. So, you know, in a very real sense, enlightenment is not reserved for the unique special few that get pointed out in society, that each and every one of us is an enlightened being. Another question that was asked, and again there were only 7, was it's a strange question. Aside from yourself, can you tell us about any living saint today, any saint who is alive today? And my response to that question was, again, sainthood is not reserved for those who are elected to that position, you know, by committee, that a group gets together and finally deifies an individual. But in reality, we are all living, wonderful saints, each and every one of us. And we can become more saintly, again, by the actions that we choose to pursue. And that's what we're seeing. We're seeing this evolution of humankind to a new level of being luminous, of just shining and being in touch with God, with energy, with through any religious or spiritual pursuit that a person may wish to engage. Mm-hmm. But it's happening, and it's a global change. And to be alive in this time, to be participating in that, is it's such a, it's an honor that you know, who would have expected it? But it's
that's really question, you know, I love your outlook. It's really terrific.
Again,
you know, I want to toss something in here because it seems apropos when you were speaking about volition. I've also been involved for a long time with intent.com, which is a website in which people, and you know, was one of the early health columnists for them, and it's a website where people share their intentions, with the idea that putting forth an intention also kind of helps shape what happens in reality or makes some contribution. In other words, there's kind of a sort of a two-sided thing. One is we can take concrete actions. We can join Safer Chemicals, Healthy Families, and take action to prevent toxic chemicals from being unregulated and you know, harming our health and the health of our children. We can, you had mentioned earlier, we can go to the website gaslandmovie.com and we can buy a DVD of Gasland and contribute to those who are trying to protect our water. But, you know, so those are concrete actions that I think we can do and we need to do in these times. And they're acts of compassion. But, you know, there's something else, which is we can also devote intention or positive wish in certain directions. And so I, as an experiment, would like to put forth a suggestion for an intention. You can call it an intention, a blessing, a prayer, you know, whatever kind of fits in with the belief system of our listeners. For something that's coming up this next week, which is, or actually in about 8 days from now, which is, you know, the film Gasland, which you and I were discussing earlier in the program, is up for an Oscar in the Best Documentary category. So I wonder, you know, as members of the general public, we can go out and buy the DVD, as you suggested, and watch the film, which is done very artfully and beautifully. So it I think it moves you, but in a good way. But we can also, if we really want to protect our water, if we want to protect the agriculture that needs the healthy water to give us our food, we can also send a positive intention for the word to get out through this film, and that perhaps it wins the Oscar. I know I'm going to be doing it. When I grew up in New York City, I used to, you know, go to baseball games, and I'm ashamed to say, but it would happen. I would sometimes pray for a home run, and sometimes, you know, and I've seen more than a few of them happen, actually, when you kind of put that intention into it. So I just wanted to ask listeners who feel so inclined to send a positive intention for the Gasland movie, helping us protect our water by winning the Oscar. And so you could, you know, kind of do that throughout the week, as well as going, of course, and watching the DVD if you want to inform yourself more. And you can also go to my website, healthjournalistblog.com, where we have a current action for water protection, as well as a whole bunch of my previous Huffington blogs that can inform you more about this issue, too. So what do you think of that, Dr. Perlmutter? Is that out there, or is that the kind of thing that maybe we should be doing?
Well, on our website, powerupyourbrain.com, we have a weekly meditation with the idea that, you know, the idea of coherence, the more people that are involved in a similar mental, spiritual, meditative pursuit, obviously the stronger the outcome. So I think that it certainly makes a lot of sense, you know, that clearly intention and focus can have an effect upon reality. I mean, that's been demonstrated.
Well, let's see if we have an effect. This will be an experiment. Let's see if we can have an effect. We'll know, you know, 2 weeks from now, and I'll see how we did. We can all see how we did on that one.
There you go.
On Gasland winning the Oscar. You know, now I have one more question, because we're kind of coming down the pike to the last 10 minutes of our show, but I do have a question from a listener asking if there are specific environmental toxins we should avoid that you would like to alert people to.
Well, that's a very good question, and I think probably the most significant environmental toxin is called stress. Mm-hmm. And it is ubiquitous. It is, you know, something that is avoidable without question. It's something that is can be treated. It can be reversed. So, you know, obviously that's not the environmental toxin that I would suspect your listener had wanted clarification on. But in my practice, I have to say that's probably the biggest issue in terms of leading to brain failure, and that is constant exposure to stress. And the mechanism is, of course, that stress leads to increased production of a certain chemical in the body called cortisol, which happens to be a potent toxin with reference to damaging the very memory center that we so depend upon. Now, beyond that, you know, certainly we're seeing a lot more issues with reference to mercury, probably as a consequence of fish contamination. We're seeing, at least down here in Florida, we are experiencing a huge issue with arsenic, because of likely because of the arsenical antifungals that are used on the thousands of golf courses that surround our homes, and the fact that that then gets into the water supply. But you know, the idea, for example, that pesticides are related to the risk of Parkinson's disease is now front and center in the mainstream neurological literature. Mm. And there are articles that talk about it. There are articles that show epidemiologically those people who are exposed are at higher risk. But in addition, now actually demonstrating higher levels of those pesticides in the Alzheimer's patient. So clearly that's an issue, especially in those individuals who are genetically predisposed to not being as able to detoxify those things that are so ubiquitous in our environment.
That Can you said, talk a little bit about that? Being...
Yeah, that said... The great news that, you know, Allison, you and I talked about early on in our conversation today is that epigenetics, the idea that we can turn on genes, allows us the ability to actually enhance those genes in our genome that deal with detoxification. So we can target our genes and turn on those genes that allow us to detoxify the very toxins that your listener had been concerned about. For example, there is a pathway called the NRF2 pathway that codes for dramatic enhancement of detoxification enzymes, things like glutathione S-transferase, very potent detoxification enzyme. And we now understand how that NRF2 pathway is regulated. Certain nutrients, for example, can powerfully turn on that gene pathway and enhance detoxification. And these include foods like broccoli, green tea extract, sulforaphane, which comes from broccoli, resveratrol, that you've probably heard so much about, and the herb turmeric, which is a powerful activator of this detoxification pathway. So, you know, this idea that turmeric can detoxify the body and reduce inflammation is brand new. I mean, the only medical literature that just started talking about this was only published just 3,500 years ago. So it's fresh off the press. And it appeared in Vedic texts in Sanskrit where the idea, you know, where turmeric was described as a way of getting away from toxicity, of getting away from inflammation. And now here we are in 2011 and we start to just begin to understand the biochemistry of turmeric. And, you know, it's very, very fascinating that we're coming full circle. One would wonder why it is that in India, for example, the risk of Alzheimer's is only one quarter of what it is in the United States. India, a country where they eat a lot of turmeric, you know, it's almost a staple found in probably almost every dish, you know, as part of the traditional Indian diet that is made with curry.
Mm-hmm. I know. I've lived in India, and it's true. It's just in absolutely everything. But you know, here's where I want to ask you a question about the whole genetic thing, because you know, there are people, for example, who don't tolerate curcumin well, and this is true of almost kind of anything. So, you know, and I'm not talking about like a specific allergy or anything, but you know, when we talk about individualization, genetics, in your book you talk about what are called SNPs, single nucleotide polymorphisms, which are basically mutations, as well as genes that are turned on and off in the epigenome. You know, how do people customize their health? You know, based upon the fact that most of us don't really know whether, for example, you know, we are part of a group that might respond well to this or that.
Allison, it's actually a very good question. And, you know, incredibly and wonderfully, we live in a time now where technology to determine our genetic predispositions and our genetic uniqueness is available to us through laboratory studies. And so, you know, part of our evaluation of our patients is to send a blood specimen to a specific laboratory where we get a printout out of which describes a whole variety of different, as you well characterize, single nucleotide polymorphisms or genetic nuances that will talk about how a person might be able to metabolize this or that, or might not, or what perhaps diseases he or she may be at risk for based upon that genetic uniqueness of that individual. So we've really come to an amazing place in time where long before a disease has manifest, we can actually determine what is unique about that person and how to cultivate lifestyle changes to more reflect what that patient specifically needs based upon his or her own unique genome. It's a very, very fascinating time. And, you know, frequently we override these single nucleotide polymorphisms with simple lifestyle issues like specific dietary changes and or exercise programs or perhaps even specific nutritional supplements.
That's fascinating. So in other words, there are both these predispositions, and there are workarounds to them.
Without a doubt.
And you can customize that. How many SNPs do you typically test in a panel?
You know, there's various panels. There are panels that deal with cardiovascular risk, with neurologic risk, with hyperinflammation. So there are any number of specific profiles that you can get. You know, if cost weren't an issue, obviously we'd order them. We'd order the maximum we could on any patient, but you know, it really depends on where that, you know, you'd first take a family history, and at that point you determine, well, this is sort of the ballpark in which we want to focus ourselves, and or, you know, any previous medical problem a person might have. So, but in an ideal world, it would be great to get all panels on all people, and then really have some very preemptive information. You know, you talk about preventive medicine, and it's nice to say, well, you should exercise, you should take some these supplements, and maybe some vitamin D because these are good for you. But you're right. Is that good for everybody? Is turmeric good for everybody? And the answer is, it is not. And I think, you know, what a great day it is that we now have this technology to be so refined in our recommendations as to be able to recommend what is the best approach for that individual based on his or her genome. So it's a very, very exciting time. And, you know, to be able to employ these very sophisticated technologies in our medical practice day to day is very exciting.
Well, this is really, you know, what you're describing is really the future of healthcare, in my opinion, in any case. You know, this is really, I mean, these kinds of potentials basically give us a way to both customize, you know, what our problems, as well as kind of show through the clinical side, not through the kinds of, you know, kind of extensive studies that just focus on a single thing, trying to either rule it in or out, but that really bring like a host of different positive inputs to bear on overriding negative factors from the environment or weaknesses in the genome, at the same time looking at the range of things that are impacting us from the society. So it almost seems like the future of health is moving from a time of, you know, just, you know, one thing at a time to a time of kind of multiplicity where we can bring all the best that there is to bear on the individual while also using what doctors like you learn in practice to kind of say what isn't working so well for people on a societal or environmental toxic level that, you know, that we should try to curb for the benefit of a large number of people.
No question. And those are the approaches that ultimately should be the cornerstones of what is truly preventive medicine. That is, not reactive medicine, not treating the cow after it gets out of the barn, but really creating programs that are individualized based upon that individual's you know, demonstrated need that then, you know, truly characterize the idea of prevention long before illness is manifest.
Mm-hmm. That's it. And it's like prevention is two levels, individual and societal, really. And, you know, thank you so much. It's just been a delight speaking with you.
I've heard you speak at conferences
for years. I look forward to seeing you present at the Integrative Health Symposium. And I recommend that listeners get your book, Power Up Your Brain, as well as check out your website, powerupyourbrain.com, and check you out and friend and follow you on the Huffington Post as well. Your articles are terrific, and it's just been a pleasure to have you here
with us today. Bye-bye.
Stay tuned for the next Connect Your Dots next Saturday at noon.